Hey, podcast listeners, welcome to the podcast for this week. It involves a character I've always been fascinated with, Lee Hazlewood. What a odd guy. You know, he made some very commercial records and some records with the cream of the studio system, right? All the Wrecking Crew musicians and big record labels. Yet, there's something very outsider-ish about all of his work. He's just from left field. And I kind of love that when true eccentric people sort of cross paths with the commercial world. It's such a just a great part of capitalism, I always think. You know, it's just the record business is so hungry, they even look at goofballs like Lee Hazlewood. Anyway, Wyndham Wallace has written this book. It's called Lee, Myself, and I, Inside the Very Special World of Lee Hazlewood. We talked to Wyndham today, and it's pretty interesting. What an interesting guy, and it's good to have some firsthand account here. Next week, I've got the week off. I'll be going to Canada. Anybody listening in Canada? I don't know. I've never heard from him. I don't know. Ian, listener Ian. There's a couple other folks, maybe. But going up to the land of Anne of Green Gables. And if you've got a 10-year-old daughter, maybe you know what that means. Fantastic books. Kim Shattuck of the Muffs will be here August 15th, 1993. The debut album from the Muffs came out. Totally loved that album. Still love it. It's just fresh and wonderful. It's being re-released with re-expanded bonus cuts, etc., etc., you know, remastered, all that stuff. So we'll have Kim to talk about that. I'm working on some other stuff, so keep your eyes over WFMU.org/Michael to see the list of upcoming guests. And, of course, you can always listen to the archives of the past programs there. Anyway, hey, thanks for subscribing. I will see you in 2 weeks. Talk to you soon. Here is Wyndham Wallace.
Here's a little song about boots and a darling named Nancy. You keep saying you got something for me. Something you call love, but confess you've been a messin' where you shouldn't have been a messin'. That's right. And someone else is getting all your best. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you. This is the part of the song where Billy Strange raised his hand and asked if he could leave the room. You keep lying when you ought to be truthful. And you keep losing when you ought to not bet. And you keep saying when you ought to be changing. Now what's right is right, but you ain't been right yet. Listen. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you. Yeah. This is the part of the record where everybody said, why, that can't be number one. You keep playing where you shouldn't be playing. And you keep thinking that you'll never get burned. Well, I just found me a brand new box of matches. And what she knows, you ain't had time to learn. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days, these boots are gonna walk all over you. You put on your boots, and I'll put on mine, and we'll sell a million records any old time. Yeah! And this is the part of the record where the engineer Eddie Brackett said, if we don't fade this thing out, we're all going to be arrested.
All right, there's some Lee Hazelwood music, and joining us on the phone is Wyndham Wallace, author of Lee, Myself, and I, Inside the Very Special World of Lee Hazelwood. And in this book, you tell the story of you going from a fan and a guy who is hired to work on one Lee Hazelwood project to really being his manager for the last 8 years of his life or so. And then it's really paints the portrait of this eccentric, strange, interesting guy. And I imagine, was this an emotionally hard to write this book for you?
Yeah, in some ways it was, actually. I don't know whether it was necessarily emotionally hard, emotionally satisfying, I think, perhaps. I mean, there were definitely bits of it which were kind of tough to write. And you know, without wishing to sound like a complete sap, there were definitely a couple of points that I wrote where I actually sort of brought myself to the verge of tears, which I kind of figured was probably quite a good thing, as long as I didn't get too indulgent. But yeah, it was a little bit difficult at times to write it, because I was very, very close, but at the same time I wanted to write a very, very honest and intimate account of our friendship, and I didn't want to gloss over, you know, what I thought were maybe his shortcomings. And so yeah, I did want it to be a sort of warts and all account. And it's not a lot of fun sort of writing things about somebody that you kind of really loved and being a little bit rude about the person from time to time. Maybe rude's the wrong word, but sort of, you know, allowing people to actually see that he was not a perfect individual. So from that perspective, it was a little bit tough at times, yes.
Well, he's certainly a guy of many contradictions, and he's certainly an eccentric guy, and you sort of paint this portrait of this guy from... the book is sort of two books. It tells your relationship with him and the business dealings and this sort of comeback of sorts that in a lot of ways you orchestrate. And then it's sort of during the downtime, it's you and him sitting at bars mostly and him telling you some of his history. So you sort of do get the history of this guy's life, and then you get the nuts and bolts of what happened in those later days. During those downtimes, did you get a feeling of why he is this way, why he is such a interesting guy, to use the politest word?
Yeah, I mean, there's a theory that I've sort of shared with a few people, and I sort of hint at during the course of the book, as to why he was so contradictory, I suppose you could say. I mean, obviously, on one hand, he was a sort of pretty ferocious character. He could be incredibly tough. He kept me on my toes all the time. And he gave the impression of having this, you know, very large ego that demanded, you know, huge amounts of respect, or else, you know, get the hell out of his house. But on the other hand, he was remarkably self-deprecating, at least about his work. And my theory was that he was actually sort of underneath this. He was a fairly sensitive and insecure guy, and that he'd built up this wall around him in order to, you know, protect himself from any kinds of criticism. And that he was also fairly keen to belittle his own work, because it basically meant he beat other people to the punch, so to speak. And one of the things that I think drew me and him together was the fact that we sort of saw certain things in one another that we recognized in ourselves. And I had been sent away to boarding school at the age of 8 in you know, the very traditional red brick British boarding school, something, you know, again, I mentioned in the book. And I had learned during the course of that time there, where I was enormously unhappy and was sort of fairly heavily bullied, at least in a sort of mentally rather than physical way, I'd learned that one of the ways to keep the bullying to a minimum was often to make the jokes at my own expense before anyone else could make them, because it took the wind out of other people's sails. And I think Lee operated in a similar fashion when it came to discussing his work. If he could say that something that he had written was dreck, as he once said, then no one else really had any ammunition left. I mean, you can't give somebody a hard time who themselves says that what they do is fairly valueless. And so I think that that's where this contradiction came from. And both of these things were kind of an act designed to protect himself from being hurt should people feel that his work was not particularly worthy.
Well, we've been listening to Lee Hazelwood related music this morning, and it's such unique stuff. It comes from such an a left field point of view. I mean, it's, you know, it clearly sticks to, he understood popular music forms, but the lyrics and the attitudes are so unusual. And so it's interesting to sort of read about him and try to see, you know, is he as unusual as the point of view of the songs?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because if you listen to These Boots Are Made for Walking, I mean, it's become so familiar to us now that you just think of it as like a classic pop hit. But when you actually sort of just take a step back, it's, even that is a kind of slightly odd song. I mean, it works in quarter tones rather than half tones, which, you know, is very unusual in Western music. So right from the very off, you know, the bass line is kind of odd. The lyrics are also kind of fairly benign, you get the sense, and yet I think perhaps they would have been had they been sung by a man, as he'd initially intended. But once he'd got Nancy to sing them, and it just kind of flipped the whole thing. And that is kind of the way that I think so much of his music works. It's very hard to define what's off about his records. And yet the very thing that makes them off is what makes them so fascinating. And I think that's why he has become increasingly recognized, as the great songwriter and performer and producer that he was. Because at the time, you can imagine, when his records came out, it didn't quite fit with what was commercially successful a lot of the time, apart from, you know, the obvious exceptions with Nancy and earlier stuff with Duane Eddy, for instance. But I would imagine if you were there hearing these records at the time, you'd be kind of like, yeah, he doesn't quite get it, does he? And now you listen to those records and you go, my God, you know, how brave to take a song like this and just put that little twist of lemon in it, you know? There's just that something a bit strange about it. It remains a little bit indefinable unless you're a sort of musicologist. But there's always just something that little bit, yeah, off, as I say. And that's why I find so seductive about his records.
Yeah, I completely agree. And it does, to me anyway, it seems like throughout the book there are examples of where he just has to kind of test people, push situations just a little, you know, just that little slice of lemon, like you say, in everything. You know, he just to make it different or just to see what would happen.
Yeah. I mean, I refer, I think, in the introduction to the book to the fact that I've always been drawn to charismatic people who don't treat me necessarily terribly well all the time, and then right at the end sort of reach out just as you're about to turn away from them or lose your temper with them. They turn to you and just give you a big hug or a gift or a smile or say that thing that you've been waiting for them to say for so long. And Lee was an absolute master of doing that, and I think that sort of applied to a lot of things in his life, you know, his personal relationships and, in a sense, his music. Because, you know, you could almost imagine sort of just turning away from his music and going, "Ha, come on, this is kitsch," and then you'd suddenly realize there was some warped line in one of the songs that just flipped it on its head, or there'd be a moment where the chorus would just go off in a direction that you'd never anticipate.
In the book, you tell the story of, it's not a comeback exactly, but it's a chance for the spotlight to get shown on Lee, and there's a lot of press, and the way he deals with the press is very interesting, and there's a lot, his records are reissued, and he plays his first solo gigs in years and years and years and years. Why did he do it? I mean, I assume he had enough money. I'm not sure about that, but it seems like it wasn't for the money.
I think it would be wrong to say that he didn't do it for the money entirely. I mean, I think that actually, that's not entirely true. I mean, the deal that he did with Steve Shelley, who kicked this whole thing off, and to whom I think, you know, the most credit is actually due, and he probably doesn't get enough. And you know, that was not a wealthy deal. But after that, Lee definitely insisted that he be paid properly for the things that he did, and he certainly refused to perform at a sort of big event that I did for the label, whose UK office I was running at the time, because we weren't going to pay him enough to step on stage and sing one song. So money was always important to him. I think he gauged the success of his work from his royalty checks and from his money, because that was probably the only way he knew how to gauge it, especially as a child of the Depression and you know, the Second World War. But it wasn't his only motivation.
Did you ever get to see him be creative? Because his creative process is very interesting to me. I mean, where did this stuff come from? How long did it take? You know, did you ever see him?
No, I never really saw him. I mean, I saw him in the studio twice, working on songs, right at the end of his life. But beyond that, no, I never, ever saw him work. I think he just had a very clear idea of what he wanted to do and how things should be, and at the same time could be very spontaneous when necessary and change things. There was one track on Cake or Death which had been originally recorded with a French singer, and the record label demanded a huge amount of money for this performer to be allowed to appear on his record. And this just made him so angry that when he came to Berlin to record a track with a big indie rock star over here called Bela B, and he met Bela's manager, who was also a singer, he just turned to her and said, right, you're going to do this song instead. Just spontaneously, he'd met her the day before. So I guess that's as good an indication as I can give of how he worked. But yeah, beyond that, I never really got to see that creative side of him. And in a way, I kind of like that. It maintained this mystery. I mean, I got to see him in such an intimate way, and yet there is this part of his life that I will never ever know about, and it's kept the mystique of those records intact for me, in a sense.
That's very interesting. I don't know what it says about me, because I always want to know, you know, how long did it take to write this? You know, I guess I love the music and I want to experience that, but somehow I feel that those details give me a closeness to the music itself. But let me remind folks, Wyndham Wallace is our guest, and Lee, myself, and I, Inside the Very Special World of Lee Hazlewood, is his new book. And we're talking about Lee Hazlewood and his really very unique catalog of music. By the end of the book, it's clear that he doesn't have long to live, and he seems to face death with, you know, as unusual a way that he faced everything else. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that would be true, yes. Yeah, I mean, he was very brave about his impending death, and he was almost like one of those people who finds out that he's going to die and sort of figures out, okay, I've got 6 months left, here's my bucket list, I'm going to start with Disneyland. And with Lee, I think it was his feeling was, right, okay, I've been diagnosed, I'm going to make one more record. And he just went for it, hell for leather. And he was determined to promote the record as much as he could. In fact, I think he even got a little bit frustrated towards the end that perhaps, you know, there wasn't as much activity as perhaps he would have liked. But yes, he just went hell for leather for it. And once that work was done, he kind of lay back on the sofa and sort of contentedly sort of slowly let himself pass. But yeah, it was a pretty strong response to the fact that he was dying. It was a kind of big middle finger to the idea of death until he'd achieved what he really, really wanted to achieve for the, you know, for his last grandstanding moment, so to speak.
Is there a favorite story of your time with him that you want to share with us?
Oh, my God, there were so many stories. I don't know, I mean, there's lots of little, I mean, there's tiny little things that I remember sort of very fondly, and then there's sort of big stories. The bigger stories tend to be shared in the book itself. I mean, there are certain things that I left out. They didn't fit in, or I didn't feel it was appropriate to share them. I think, to be honest, I think one of the things I remember, which it might seem like a very small thing, but to me it was really, really just a fabulously beautiful moment. When he came over to record that duet here in Berlin with Bela, the guy I mentioned earlier, before we went into the studio, he came over to my apartment, and because there were a couple of lines in the song in German, he wanted me to make sure he could pronounce the words properly, and he wanted to familiarize himself with the song as well. The kind of further evidence that he liked money as much as he did anything, because he hadn't really bothered to listen to the song before he'd agreed to doing it. And so he was sitting here, and he was listening to the song, and we were chatting away and stuff, and he really liked my apartment. But he said to me, you know what, I think you need to get yourself a bigger apartment. I said, well, I'm not sure I do, to be honest. He said, yeah, you need an extra room. I'll pay for it. I just want to be able to come over here and stay with you from time to time. And that was, it's not a wild anecdote. It's not, you know, it's not any of one of, you know, Lee's hell-raising moments, but that was a beautiful moment for me.
Different artists' contributions to sort of the history of popular music. You know, everybody has their own thing. What is the most important thing you think that Lee Hazlewood legacy contributes to the general history of pop music?
Cool, that's a difficult question. I'm really not sure what I'd say. I mean, for starters, there's the sound of his records, which I think Phil Spector might want to possibly tip his hat towards Lee for, having been an intern of Lee's for a short period of time. And I think that's vital. I mean, this cavernous sound that he made, I think he made duets more edgy in a way as well. I think that was another fabulous thing he's done. I mean, anybody who records a duet today that isn't making them for the mainstream pop charts, I think, has to have heard a Lee Hazelwood song at some point, you know, a Lee and Nancy or a Lee and Susie Jane song, for instance. So I think that's another, you know, vital thing he's done. I mean, another thing that I think is also enormously important that Lee did, which is perhaps less commented on, is that without Lee, there may never have been a Duane Eddy. And without a Duane Eddy, there would never have been a Twang. And without the Twang, arguably, the rock and roll would be a considerably less imaginative-sounding art genre or art form, so to speak. So I think that's a very, very significant thing.
Have you got a favorite Lee Hazelwood song we should play to end up this interview today?
You know, I get asked that question, obviously, quite a lot. And I've still never really decided which my favorite song is. It's normally between one of three songs. If I can choose one of three, and then you can maybe choose which you think your listeners would like the most. One of them is perhaps one of the rarer songs from his catalog. It's taken from a movie soundtrack called A House Safe for Tigers. So this song called Soul's Island, which is this grand, dramatic, string-laden, six-minute tune about Gotland, the island in Sweden where he used to like to spend his summers during the 70s. I think that's an absolutely majestic tune that very few people know. You can go to the other end of the scale and go Some Velvet Morning, which I think is probably the greatest duet ever recorded. I think the eroticism and the doom and the magic of that song are just, you know, beyond comprehension. And then there's just one other song that I always return to over and over and over again, which is My Autumn's Done Come, which is this extraordinary prescient song about old age and about sort of becoming not resigned, but comfortable with the idea of being an old man. Remarkably, it was a song that he wrote in his 30s. But that song in so many ways seems to sum Lee up. It's kind of got this wonderful, lethargic, rich quality to it. And then these fabulous lyrics like... was it string me a hammock between two trees, leave me alone, damn it, let me do what I please. I think that's pretty much the epitaph that I would imagine Lee might have thought of having on his gravestone. So yeah, one of those three songs, I would say, is probably as good as it gets. And that would be the way I would tell people to start their Lee Hazelwood obsession.
Wyndham Wallace has been our guest. Lee, myself, and I, inside the very special world of Lee Hazelwood. And what's the best website to take a look at your work?
Well, my own personal work, I guess, wyndhamwallace.com, which I really do need to update at the moment. I've been so busy since the book came out, I haven't put anything up there. But that has a catalogue of all the sort of, you know, a lot of the writing that I've done and some of my photography, and I've done a few travel books, and I do subtitling of movies and things like that. So if people want to know a little bit about me, that's where to go. If they want to get hold of the book itself, probably the best place to go is actually, well, there's the obvious candidates, the big websites, but I'd put a shout out to Life in the Attic, who are carrying the book on their website and have done an absolutely remarkable job of reissuing some of Lee's catalogue over the last few years. And so I would heartily encourage people to go to their site and buy it there.
Yeah, great label and good people. Well, Wyndham, thanks very much. Let's hear from Lee Hazelwood.
Thanks a lot.
Some velvet morning when I'm straight, I'm gonna open up your gate and maybe tell you about Phaedra and how she gave me life and how she made in. Some velvet morning when I'm straight, flowers growing on a hill, dragonflies and daffodils learn from us very much.
some velvet morning when I'm straight. I'm gonna open up your gate and maybe tell you about Phaedra and how she gave me life and how she made it in.
Flowers are the things we know. Secrets are the things we grow. Learn from us very much. Look at us, but do not touch. Phaedra is my.
Some velvet morning when I'm straight.
Flowers growing on a hill.
I'm gonna open up your gate.
Dragonflies and daffodils.
And maybe tell you about Phaedra. How she gave me life.
Look at us, but do not touch.
And how she made it.